1977, a group of 40 people from Bethany Bible Church started a Sunday school class, and they were meeting and praying about planting a church in an undeveloped area of town called North Phoenix. It was a wasteland at Bell and Tatum. There was nothing but cactus and roadrunners and things like that. But they sensed that the city was expanding north, and that not only would the need arise for new homes and things like that, but also churches. And so they planted, 1977, Desert Springs Bible Church. For 9 years, met out of local elementary schools, including Liberty Elementary, which this is the old Liberty Elementary, if you guys are familiar with Liberty. And they met there for 9 years. At the same time, they raised funds and they bought property, undeveloped property, in the mid-1980s. This is way back then. On Tatum and Paradise Lane. And in 1985, they built the building that's closest to Tatum, which is now our student center. After that, they built the two-story building as our kids' building, and then eventually this building in the mid-1990s. Many of us have benefited from the ministry of people who we've never met. We, in a sense, are a legacy of God's faithfulness and blessing through the generations of those who've come before us. And so, as a church family, we recognize that God has been working in and through Desert Springs for decades and that we're invited to be part of it. And one of the things that we've been thinking through as a now 48-year-old church, we're almost 50 years old, and you guys look awesome for your age, I got to tell you. 48-year-old church, we've been praying that God would give to us a fresh vision for how we express our core values and the mission that God's given to us. 1977, this group of folks gathered together because they believed in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, that was so profound of a truth that it compels us to not only worship, but also to action and to share that good news. And we continue on that legacy, but we've been praying that God would give to us a fresh vision, some of which we've shared over the last couple of years, and we're going to continue to share that this year. And one of the things that we're doing in these first few weeks of 2025 is we're looking at the book of Acts, specifically thinking about how the earliest followers of Jesus expressed their faith and lived out the gospel, and then learning from them and gaining a wisdom and ideas from them, how they lived in their day for how we can live in our day. And so we're calling the series Strange Religion because Christianity, when it showed up in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago, was very strange. It was counterintuitive, it was countercultural in many senses, so much so that many people viewed Christians with not only curiosity but also suspicion. They were quite strange. They didn't operate like many people who were operating in the Roman Empire. And to this day, for those of us that live in the American Empire, we might find that living the way of Jesus is also strange, that following the path that Jesus has for us might be considered odd or out of sorts or strange, no matter what empire we find ourselves in. And so we're going to look to the book of Acts, recognizing this is the earliest followers of Jesus, figuring out how to live out their faith then, and we're going to gain a wisdom for how we can live today. We're going to be today in Acts chapter 17. If you have a Bible, I'd invite you to turn there. If you're joining us online, you can open up a new browser, go to Bible.com. We're using the Christian Standard Version of the Bible, but whatever version you have is great. It's also, I believe, printed in your handouts if you'd like to follow along. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but just pick up a few little bits. But the context here is that there's this dude named Paul who had a radical conversion experience later in his life. So he had initially, you meet him earlier in the book of Acts, as a guy named Saul, and he had been persecuting Christians. He had intentionally been trying to shut Christianity down. He was really trying to silence Christians. He thought they were a threat to his way of being in the world. And then he has this power encounter with Jesus where his whole world changes because he meets Jesus. And his whole world turns around as he starts to follow Jesus. And you see in the book of Acts that Paul begins to walk the way of Jesus. And one of the things that he does is he goes into different towns and cities and he talks to people about Jesus. So he's proclaiming the gospel. Now, this in Paul's day was quite normal. It was very normal in the 2,000 years ago in the Roman Empire for people to come into a city and proclaim things, to say good news. It was very common. We might think it's weird. Like, have you guys ever seen, like, one of those folks with bullhorns on the side of the, on the sidewalk, on a milk crate, yelling about Jesus? That is strange and not great, actually. I don't think that that works. Jesus tells us to, like, share the good news while also being like Jesus, and he didn't really bullhorn people into his way of being in the world. But in Paul's day, it was very normal for people to come into a town. This is pre-internet, pre-cell phone. This is before the television. This is in the Wayback Machine. And the way that news would spread is people would come into town and they would say, good news, and they would share whatever the good news is. So Paul comes into these different places and he shares the good news and he's very open about it, which is very normal in Paul's day. But he's in this place in Acts chapter 17 called Athens, which is in Greece. And at this point in time, it's under the Roman Empire. And Athens is a very religious city. It's a city full of gods, full of philosophers, full of people who are going around with pipes going, you know, thinking about the deep things of life. And in Athens, and Athens gets its name from Athena. It's named after a Greek goddess. And it's as a town, it was just known even in Paul's day for being full of religious iconography, religious thinking people, philosophers, and they all kind of argued with each other and, you know, whose religious or philosophy was better. And so when Paul comes in, he's adding to a conversation that's already been going on. But one of the things that Paul does, and you see it in verse 16 and on of Acts chapter 17, Paul walks around the city and he notices that there's all these different gods. And these different gods are like named like, you know, Athena, Zeus, etc. And he notices that there's this statue to an unknown god. So the Athenians were so religious that they wanted to make sure that they got like even the miscellaneous like gods that they didn't know about. And so they built statues to that god. Now, we might think that's strange, but I want to just notice that we also live in an empire where there are tens of thousands of statues to the gods of sex, money, and power. We just don't call them idols anymore. And they usually don't have human form in stone, but we have monuments all over the place of the gods that we worship. So we are just like the Greeks in that regard. And in fact, we might think it's strange. Oh, they were so religious. They were so like idolaters. But we're the worship of the gods was simply a way to talk about valuing as the ultimate thing sex, money, and power. You're familiar with this. Like the gods all represented different aspects of what humans wanted, what they valued the most. So when you would make a sacrifice to one of the gods, you're basically saying, I want what they've got. Because I want the thing, the money, the power, the influence, whatever it might be. So in that way, we're kind of just like them. We build monuments to the gods that we serve too. We also have, kind of latent in our culture, this like idea that there's some kind of god. We use language like higher power. It's, many of us, we will say that there's an unknown god up there. You know, kind of like the unit, sometimes we'll refer to it as the universe. I'll hear people say things like, the universe wanted me to be late to work today. If there's one thing I know about the cosmos, is it wants you dead. It is a vacuous, cold space that if you try to go into space, like the universe, it will kill you. We have to put suits on just to go up into there, right? It doesn't want you. The universe does not think about you, by the way. Which is one of the things that makes Christianity so strange, given the nature of like the universe, that it's so vast and so cosmic and so beautiful and yet so inhospitable to human life, that we find in the following and the teaching of Scripture that, well, God actually designed this for you out of love. That's quite strange in human history. The idea that you are made with inherent dignity, worth, and value, that you are delighted in, that you are loved by the Creator God of the cosmos. God is not indifferent to us. At least that's what I understand to be the teaching of Scripture. So in the book of Acts, you see in Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul stands up in front of people, verse 22, and it says that Paul stood up in the middle of the Areopagus, which is this large gathering space, and he says, "People of Athens, I see that you are extremely religious in every respect. For as I was passing through and observing the objects of your worship, I found an altar on which there was inscribed to an unknown God." And he goes on in his proclamation to quote their poets, talking the way that they talk, trying to answer the questions they're asking and pointing to Jesus. In fact, I'd invite you, read what Paul says in Acts chapter 17. Later today, when you go home and read your whole Bible, pay special attention to Acts chapter 17, because what Paul's doing is he is, number one, recognizing what the questions they're asking, and then he's showing how Jesus is answering those questions. In fact, I want to just notice three things here about Paul's very strange ministry here in Athens. Number one, Paul cared about the city. Paul walked around, you just heard it just a moment ago. Paul walked around the city and observed. He has a care for this city that he finds himself in. The reason why I think this is important for us is because there are so many people who will come into a city and say, you know, here's my truth, you need to hear my truth, and they do so out of derision for the city or condemnation for the community. But I want you to notice that Paul here is operating out of a heart of love. He loves and cares for the city, so much so that he observes and studies the city. He doesn't just get on a milk crate and yell and scream on a bullhorn. He tries to the best of his ability to be winsome and kind and compassionate, learning the kinds of questions that they're asking and then introducing them to Jesus. This is instructive for those of us who want to share the good news of Jesus. It's not a bunch of yelling and screaming. It's reasoning with. It's hearing what this person's needs are and then saying, I think Jesus might be an answer to that need. It's considerate, it's compassionate, it's winsome. Number two, he shared about Jesus. He said, you know, you have this need that I observed as I was walking around your city. And I think I have found an answer to that question. What do you see? Now, here's the response. There are two responses that people had to Paul in Athens. One response was, tell me more about Jesus. People heard about him talk about like the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. They're like, fascinating, tell me more. Other people, you know what their response was? It says it in the text. They laughed at him. These are completely normal responses. Sometimes when you tell someone, hey, the creator of the universe took on human flesh 2,000 years ago, then they died on a cross, and then guess what happened? 3 days later, they rose from the grave, conquering over Satan, sin, and death, and he stands victorious all over all things, and one day he'll return to restore all that which is broken, and he invites you, turn and follow him. Some people say, I'd like to know more, totally normal response, and some people say, that sounds ridiculous. Do you know why people say that sounds ridiculous? You guys are smart. You already know the answer. Why do people say, that sounds ridiculous? Because it sounds ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous unless it happened. Like, Easter is dumb unless it happened. So one of the things that Paul is recognizing as he shares about Jesus is he's standing on a firm foundation. Because getting up in front of a bunch of people and saying something that sounds ridiculous just to get some people saying, ooh, that sounds interesting, and other people to say, that sounds crazy and laughing, the only way one can actually do that with integrity is to recognize this thing I'm saying is true, and I just invite you to see it. It's a firm foundation. There's this old hymn that the first time I know that it was written down, based on my extensive hymnody historical study and research, which means Wikipedia, 2 days ago. So, in 1787 was the first time this was written down, and it was a collection of folk hymns So very early on in America's history. And it's become one of the most popular hymns throughout American history. In fact, this hymn will show up in American history multiple times by presidents or leaders or communities of people, especially when there's disunity and conflict within the community. And the hymn is, some of you may be familiar with it, "How Firm a Foundation." You guys ever heard of that song, "How Firm a Foundation"? I'm not going to sing it for you, Merry Christmas, but I'll give you just a few of the lines. Remember, we're thinking about Paul standing on this firm foundation as proclaiming the gospel. The hymn goes like this: "How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in his excellent word. What more can he say than to you he hath said, you who unto Jesus for refuge have fled." What the hymn is getting at is we stand on this firm foundation, and this firm foundation, this proclamation, this thing that God has said is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. The message that God is speaking to us that is our foundation is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And Paul recognizes that this is his firm foundation. And it's the foundation of this congregation. We live in light of the gospel because we believe that Jesus has given his life for us, that he has died, that he rose again on the third day. We believe that this is the foundation that God has laid for us. And standing on that foundation, we live in light of it. Friends, I don't know where you're at today. I don't know what concerns are weighing on you. I don't know what situation you are carrying on your shoulders. I don't know what uncertainties, what circumstances, what burdens. I don't know what the workplace holds. I don't know what your home holds. I know a bit about what our community is up to and weighing on us. Though these things are so real, we are reminded by this hymn and even by Paul's teaching that we stand on a firm foundation, that the word that God speaks to us so vividly is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And that foundation is the proclamation of Paul, and it's the foundation and proclamation of this congregation because we need a foundation. I want you to take a big, deep breath in. Let it out. I just want you to consider all that weighs on us, all the uncertainties. How can we possibly bear it if we're not on a firm foundation? Moreover, I would invite you to broaden your imagination. To those in your home, your family, your workplace, your community, we need a foundation, and there are many in our community who are desperately searching for something firm to build their life upon. And for 48 years, this congregation has been about the business of proclaiming that truth. About 24 years ago, I was introduced to this congregation. I was invited to play the drums. I grew up in a great home. Parents loved me, dragged me to church a bunch as a kid, and as soon as I could, I got out. Some of you are like, when's that going to be for me? Just solidarity. I got you. I get it. I really didn't want anything to do with church. I kind of envisioned it as, you know, a bunch of people in power making rules and telling me to do stuff that they weren't even doing, and I just really didn't want what I thought they were selling. And in my teenage years, kind of high school age, I was just desperately searching for a foundation. And one of the places I found that in was in a group of neo-Nazi skinheads. So the ideology of neo-Nazi skinhead is white supremacy. But I want to be clear, I wasn't like reading a genetics book saying, oh, I see, white people are the master race. I should go find some like-minded individuals to pal around with. That's not how it worked. I was at a party. There's a bunch of skinheads there. They looked tough. They looked like they were having a good time. And they said, come over here. I said, me? And they said, yeah, come on, let's hang out. And then it became a rhythm where they call you up, hey, you want to go to a party? And over time, I was discipled into this community. And the reason why I gave myself over to being a skinhead was not primarily the ideas. It was because it was a place for me to find safety, belonging, and purpose. I so desperately needed a foundation, and I thought I was going to get it because they called me brother, they were going to look out for me, they were tough, they had access to girls and beer, which was like the number one thing I was interested in at the time. But you know, over time I found that though the group offered safety, belonging, and purpose, it was a lie. You see, one of the ways that you know you truly belong is that you can ask any question without fear of being excluded from the community. One of the ways to test if you're truly belonging is that you're free to say whatever is in here out loud without fear of expulsion. That's one of the reasons why at Desert Springs, we celebrate excellent questions. We love questions. There's not a question you can't ask and be afraid of being excluded from the communion. We believe that God is big enough for any questions and that our faith often grows with questions. For me, being a part of that movement was really an answer to the deep needs that I have and continue to have, safety, belonging, and purpose. And after I left that movement, I was a drummer and I got asked to play the drums at Desert Springs Bible Church in North Phoenix. And I thought, sure, I'll go do that. And so I played the drums right over there. It was a different drum set at the time. Is better than the one that we've got now. And I was invited by you into a community that I didn't necessarily believe a lot of what you guys were believing. And I was not changed by the sermons. I wasn't really changed by the music. I'm going to tell you what changed my life. Some of y'all invited me into your home, and you were kind to me. You were like Jesus to me. And you suffered through all of my crazy. You continue to do so. And as I'm ragey and trying to process and, you know, just all this stuff going on as a man in his young 20s, you showed me patience and compassion. You showed me kindness. You showed me long-suffering. You showed me the way of Jesus and how you behaved towards me. I was baptized there shortly after, came on staff in 2006, became the lead pastor in 2015, and you have been so kind and gracious and loving. Last 4 years of my life have been the hardest 4 years, for a variety of different reasons. And especially about 3 and 4 years ago, I was strongly considering throwing in the towel. I was done being a pastor. I didn't really want to be a part of what I thought was really painful and confusing, and I was toast. And yet you continued to minister to me. You were kind to me. You were hospitable. You would ask me questions like, how can I pray for you? You would love on my family. You are a gift and a blessing to me. And one of the things that God has done in and through you is an encouragement to me. You have been an encouragement. You have been a source of strength. And moreover, it is because of you being faithful to the way of Jesus that I continue to serve as a pastor. I wouldn't do it if I didn't see Jesus in you. I say all that not to draw attention to myself. I just say that because I know many of you have a similar story, that you have found something in this communion of saints. You have found something of the way of Jesus that's ministered to you. You have found some expression of a firm foundation that has drawn you in. For those of you who are newer to Desert Springs, maybe you're still trying to figure out what it means to follow Jesus, you are more than welcome here. We welcome everybody. We are weird, but you are most welcome. And I'm not saying this to like self-aggrandize or anything like that. I'm just saying if we weren't sensing Jesus here, it would be kind of dumb for us to keep doing this, right? And that's what's so strange about the gospel is that it unites a bunch of misfits and then we get to be like Jesus to each other. As we step into this new year, I want to invite you, number one, to recognize how God has used this church family to show you the way of Jesus. Whatever your story, whatever your background, just are you seeing Jesus? Are you experiencing Jesus in this communion? And then second, and this is my invitation for us as a church for this next year, how can we be that more so for our community in this year? I was invited in. I believe that there are more in our community that God is inviting us to invite in. Not to hear sermons, although they're great. I mean, don't get me wrong. Pastor Don does a great job. Not to hear music, not really to sit in seats and receive content, but to have an experience of the living God in and through his people, in the way that we are towards each other, in the way that we live the kingdom with each other, that we might embody the firm foundation. When we're inviting people in, we're not inviting them to a religious institution or a platform or a content distributor. We're inviting them into a communion whose heart beats as one with God's and who lives like Jesus with each other. And so in the back of the seat in front of you, I'm going to ask you if you would please, there's a card that says pray for Phoenix. So I'd ask that you would grab one of those, please. Grab that from the back of the seat in front of you. There's also some available in the lobby if you don't have one near you. And you'll notice that on the front it says pray for Phoenix. That's kind of self-explanatory. I don't think I need to say more. But then on the back, there's just some empty lines. And here's what I'm inviting us to do. Over the next 2 months, between now and the end of February, I'm asking that you would place this somewhere that you're going to see it throughout your day, the fridge, dashboard, mirror, whatever it is, just to be reminded to be in prayer for our community. But then also, as people come to mind that God puts on your heart, would you write their names down and then commit to praying for them? So let this be a reminder, not just to pray for Phoenix, but also to pray specifically for people that God brings to mind. I don't know who the people are. It's totally between you and God. There's no like rules, like what do I pray for them for? Just whatever. We don't want to overcomplicate it. But as you make your list, just to be reminded to pray specifically for people. And then if you would please, be praying each day, and then we're going to return. And then on February 23rd, at the end of our, at the end of a couple of months, we're going to gather as a church on that Sunday, and we're going to pray over all the names. So as a collective, we will pray for Phoenix, and we'll share more about that as it comes. But just as a reminder, if you'd like, we have text. If you text PFP, pray for Phoenix. Text PFP to this phone number. This is also available in your handout, and we'll send out periodic prayer prompts just to be thinking together as a community and as a church family. How can we be praying for our community? How can we live like Jesus in our community? And then also in the lobby are these stickers. There's stickers and magnets. If you would grab some of those and just put them in a place that'll help you remember throughout the year, we're going to be praying for our community, praying for Phoenix, and praying specifically for the people that God brings to mind. As we enter into this season of prayer, we do so praying for our community. We want to serve our community. We want to proclaim the gospel to our community. We want to live the gospel. But we're centering this in prayer because prayer focuses our minds and hearts on our foundation. We don't do this out of our own strength or out of our own will. We do so out of the strength and the foundation of Jesus Christ.